Association and IndieBirth.com. No material on this podcast should be considered medical advice. Birth is not a medical event.
Welcome to IndieBirth series of podcasts here on iTunes, Taking Back Birth. Hi, Maren here today with another really awesome guest. I have Rixa Fries here today, and really excited to speak with Rixa about all she's doing in the birth world, as well as her own personal birth experience. I've been following Rixa's blog for many years, so I'm super honored to have her here. Formerly, Dr. Rixa Fries, doctor, you're a doctor, is a researcher, professor, and mother of four young children. Her interests include midwifery, home birth, unassisted birth, autonomy and informed consent, and breech birth. So welcome, Rixa. Thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's my pleasure.
Yeah. Well, we have so much to talk about, but let's start with what you're up to now. Maybe you can kind of give us the lay of the land and we'll go backwards.
Okay. So right now I'm heavily involved in breech birth.
Yeah.
Pretty much everything and anything involving breech, I'm in there somewhere.
Yeah. And where did that interest come from?
So it started with reading a book about 10 years ago. If you know Jennifer Block's book, Pushed.
Yep.
I read it, and there was this one part in it about when she went to the first International Breech Conference in Vancouver, BC, in the year 2006 or 7, I believe. And she described this conference where, probably for the first time for many of these people, these international breech experts got together and started sharing and learning from each other in person about breech birth, and specifically about more upright physiological breech birth. And she wrote about the conference and described this really great collaboration going on, and wrote about the attendees watching an unassisted home breech twin video. And I was so intrigued. I got the video soon after and watched it. At the time, I was involved in doing my dissertation research, which was about unassisted birth in North America. And so I was really drawn towards a lot of these stories. And so I was so fascinated by this idea of more upright physiological breech birth, so that when the second International Breech Conference came around in Ottawa, Ontario in 2012, I said, okay, I need to find a way to get myself there. So I need to do some research so I can present something. You know, I could have attended, but I also wanted to get some institutional funding and help pay for my airfare if I had some research to present. Actually, no, at that point, I was self-funded. Just kidding. I wasn't working for Wabash College yet. So anyway, but I thought, okay, I want to get myself there. And the best way to get myself there is to have something to present. So I collaborated with Julie Searcy, who was a PhD student at the time. I had just graduated the year before, finished my PhD. So we did a series of surveys of women who had either had a breech baby during pregnancy at some point and or a breech birth. We had something like 900 responses. They were long, open-ended surveys, some with multiple choice, some with open-ended essay answer questions. And we looked at women's experiences of having a breech baby and or a breech birth. So that got me to the conference. And of course, that was amazing to meet Dr. Leuven. He presented his preliminary results of his research doing upright breech births in his clinic in Frankfurt.
Right.
And there's a ton of interest around that. There was Dr. Gimofsky there, who analyzed the term breech trial and critiqued a lot of its findings. We had just an amazing group of people. So I did that. I went to the next breech conference a couple years later. Let me think of the years. Actually, I think the first one might have been in 2009. And then the third one, 2009. That was the second international one in Ottawa. And then the third one was in 2012, I believe, in Washington, D.C. And so I've started writing up summaries of these conference presentations, because otherwise they're very ephemeral. They're given to the group, and then you might have to keep them in your memory, but otherwise they're gone. Right. And so I said, I need to capture this information, because otherwise it's not going to exist except in memory, and it won't be written down anymore. So I started writing down conference summaries, and they got more detailed and more elaborate with each conference I went to. And so you'd see me typing like a mad woman in the audience presentation and recording it as I went so I could verify my summaries. And then I'd usually double check with the presenters afterwards to make sure my summaries were accurate. And then I'd publish them on my, put them on my blog.
Yeah, that is such a gift. And I want to say thank you for that, because that's something that I've certainly used as a resource personally and even with our students. It's just such amazing information. I feel like saying, thanks, Rixa. Like, I couldn't be at that conference, but your notes are excellent. And, you know, that's doing such a service. Like, why is it so hard to find this stuff, you know, out there on the internet? You have to be present a lot of the time at these things. So thank you. That has been a really invaluable service to so many already.
Oh, that's good to hear. Because sometimes I put these things out in the ether and then you wonder how much they're actually getting read. But I have a lot of training as a historian. As part of my graduate program, I did, among other disciplines, quite a bit of history, history of medicine in particular. And there's a real value in preserving this knowledge that otherwise will disappear. So yes. As much as it's really exhausting to go to these conferences and have to take notes every single minute and not just be able to sit and enjoy, it's worth it for me because it's so valuable to have that information for myself and for other people. So I did the same thing in Amsterdam in 2016 and this year in Sheffield in 2017. And, you know, in the future, I hope to keep doing this as much as I can, travel and find funding to go to places so that I can capture this amazing breach knowledge that's happening. So that got me started in breach. And I was kind of interested in going to these conferences, but wasn't really doing anything until about last year, when I had a little more time when I was living in France. All four of my kids were in school, and I started dedicating myself to going through every single reference on breach that exists in PubMed since the beginning of PubMed, which is in the mid-1800s, give or take. In preparation for doing a lot of other projects. So I also organized a breach training workshop in 2011 in Indianapolis. We brought in Betty Ann Davis from Ottawa and Dr. Peter O'Neill from Ontario. But that was about the extent of what I had done. So conference summaries and some vaginal breach workshops. So then last year I dedicated myself, because I had all these projects I wanted to start working on again, in part because my youngest is 4, she's in preschool, starting to have a little bit more time during the day, and I'm really interested in getting my professional life going a little more. I've been working on stuff the whole time, researching, writing, blogging, activism, but I haven't been doing it in a paid setting. And at some point I would love to find a job, because so far it's been completely unpaid as far as all this birth work I've done. And I love it, but it's not sustainable in the sense of bringing money in to support my family. So in the hopes of getting enough publications under my belt, and also because I love it, I started doing a lot more work with breach. So at the same time, I was interviewing American physicians who are still attending breech births in hospitals. We're doing a project on barriers and facilitators to vaginal breech birth in hospitals. And so I'm still working on that, still doing interviews and actively trying to recruit anybody who's still attending or recently has been attending breech births in America. And hopefully we'll expand that to international providers after I finish with my US cohort. And so then I went through all of the PubMed citations, and as I went through them, I organized them all into categories and subcategories so that now if I want to find something, I can find them all with a single click depending on the topic I'm looking for. So for example, I want to find all of the things that talk about cord prolapse or presenting cord, and I have them all organized in a category called cord prolapse, and I just click on them and they all come up. So I did that for everything. There was about 4,200 articles that came up when I did the search in PubMed.
Oh my goodness.
And it's, now that I have done it, it took about 3 or 4 months of full-time work. It was insane because it's so tedious. I mean, you're sitting there, click, right. You read through the abstract. If you, you know, I get the full text if I could, but if not, I read the abstract. And I have to decide, okay, what category or categories does it fit into, and then organize it and label it, you know. But now that I did that, I can find things so easily. And I found things that nobody's ever talked about before because they're lost in the literature. You know, there might be some random German article that's been never translated into English or something in Russian that I was able to track down. And I said, that title sounds interesting. And then I would get one of my Russian friends to find it for me in their library and tell me what it says. And then I'm like, oh, this is interesting. Nobody's ever talked about this before.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, we're overlapping here. Skype is acting up. Yeah, I mean, I've definitely seen some of the really cool things you've posted or translated, but give us an example, like what's been one of the most insightful things from the past that you've kind of brought back as far as education or, you know, things around breach for those of us that are around now.
Well, let's see. So one thing I'm really excited about, but I can't tell you exactly because I'm still waiting on the translations, is this Russian obstetrician named Sovian, who was around, published things in the 1950s. And he developed these two different methods for vaginal breech birth, one of which is really similar to the Brocht method, which basically replicates gravity, but the woman's on her back. So it follows the curve of the sacrum. And you basically lift a Frank breech baby up around the curve of the sacrum, much as Brocht did, much as Thiessen did. And the other thing he did was innovate a way to turn a footling breech into a complete breech during labor, where you apply gentle counter pressure to the foot or feet as they're emerging at the introitus. And as the baby descends, but you keep your hand there, it just flexes the legs back up again.
That's awesome.
With the idea that it might mitigate some of the risks of footling, because then you have a wider presenting part to, you know, bring more space or, you know, open up the vaginal canal a little bit more so that by the time the head comes through, it's a lot easier. And so he developed that method as well. And it actually is widely known in Russia and surrounding countries, Ukraine, the Czech Republic, Poland, and Hungary. They're in, you know, modern day Czech textbooks. He's in there. His methods are very widely known, but has never ever made his way into any English literature.
Wow.
And the only way I even figured it out is I just saw this one title saying like the new method of breech presentation, and that was it. There was no abstract. It was in Russian, and I got in touch with Katerina Prokova, who's doing a lot of things in Russia in the childbirth movement there, and she sent me some pictures from her textbooks, and she's like, oh yeah, we all know about this guy. Wow, this is so interesting. Wow. And so now I found maybe 13 or 15 articles, I'd have to count, in all these different languages, none of which I speak. I don't speak Polish or Czech or Hungarian or Russian, that have written about this method. And so I'm really excited because I have a group of translators who at some point, they're volunteers, but at some point I'm hoping to get all these translations done and then write an article summarizing the results of this method, which again is widely known in certain areas, but has not crossed the political or linguistic boundaries outside of Russia and neighboring countries. So it's this kind of thing that I'm discovering. There's huge troves of knowledge that we might have lost because it just got lost in the archive somewhere and it didn't get translated and it just disappeared, you know. Another thing that I found that was very interesting was an article about the risk of umbilical cord prolapse in breech. And that's one of the reasons that footling breech is generally contraindicated for vaginal breech birth.
Right.
Because it has a higher rate of cord prolapse. Actually, as does complete. Complete has a higher rate than Frank. But that's one of the reasons. And it was interesting, is this German article, never been translated until I had this wonderful woman help me do a translation of it, where we discovered, cord prolapse is more common for non-Frank breaches, especially for footling, but it's much, much less dangerous. It's actually the most dangerous in a Frank breach. Mm-hmm. It's as dangerous in a Frank as in a cephalic, but for non-Frank, it's actually not very dangerous. In other words, you have more time to get the baby out. The mortality rate is not related to time between diagnosis and delivery as it is with cephalic or Frank. So these kinds of things that I'm finding, these are just two examples, are so interesting because this just does not exist in the English literature, the Anglo-Saxon obstetric world, basically.
That's fascinating. And I mean, the obvious is that would really start to mitigate some of the fear, you know, that's around breech and the reason that women have so much trouble finding practitioners. So the obvious question I think is, do you intend to compile this information? Like how do you plan to get this out so that we can all learn from it?
So I have a lot of projects in the works right now. Some of these I want to turn into journal articles, but the thing I'm working on right now that I'm most excited about is a textbook about physiological breech birth in. It's spearheaded by Sean Walker, who's a midwife in the UK and a breech expert who does trainings around the world. And Anka Reiter is part of it. She worked with Dr. Lubin, and now she has her own clinic in Frankfurt that does upright breech birth.
Right.
And we have a fantastic illustrator, Kate Evans, also known as Cartoon Kate. So we're working on our first chapter of this textbook, and I'm super, super excited about it. And this is one place that I can use to consolidate all of this research that I've been doing. as well as writing articles that are maybe not really relevant for the textbook, but that, you know, that would be interesting for other people. For example, the article about the Russian obstetrician Sobyan and his methods, I think that'd be fantastic to have in a medical journal somewhere.
Oh my gosh, yes. Yeah, and well, we'll all anxiously await this textbook, obviously. I mean, it's so hard to get a hold of this information. Obviously, it's hard as midwives to even get training. You know, so much of it obviously is happening in other countries and in hospitals. And there's many people that are left out of learning, you know, continuing to further their knowledge around breech. And it's so important, obviously.
For sure.
Yeah.
So I have a whole bunch of articles and chapters in the pipeline that within hopefully the next year or two will start coming out. I actually have one article that I finished in collaboration with an obstetrician who does home births. And we wrote about a series of breech and cephalic home births that he did in his practice and analyzed the outcomes. And that's currently submitted and it's just under review right now. So that should hopefully be coming out within the next month or so.
Yeah. I can't wait to read that.
Yeah, excuse me. And so let's see what other projects I have going on right now. I mean, that's going to take a while to get the textbook done, to be honest.
Yeah.
I also want to create a resource. So with all this research I've been doing and categorizing these articles in PubMed, I want to find some way to make it publicly accessible where I write basically an annotated bibliography explaining my methods, like how I categorize things into groups, so what you would find in each category and why I put them there, and then, you know, make everything online. Because I can make these categories on publicly available. I can change the settings on PubMed. And so everybody could benefit from the research I've done. And I think it'd be a really useful resource because it's different than anything else that's out there. It's different than a systematic review or meta-analysis because I'm taking everything. You know, a meta-analysis or a systematic review is also useful, but they restrict it to a very narrow set of data that's relevant to their question. Whereas my question is, what is everything that's ever been written about breech?
Yeah. That's an awesome question. Everything that's ever been written about breech.
At least that's on PubMed, right, with that qualification. There are things that don't always show up on PubMed.
Right.
But if I could write an article explaining my methodology and how I categorize things, because, you know, maybe my way of organizing wouldn't make sense to somebody else, but at least I can explain it and say, you'll find X, Y, and Z in these categories and then make it available. I would love to do that as some kind of a resource and then update it every 6 months to a year so that people know who are using it, that it's updated constantly.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
Yeah. Again, it's tough because I'm doing all these things with no funding and I'm working essentially full time with no pay.
Right. That's really rough.
I know. In the birth world, there's this whole tendency we have to be like, well, we don't want to charge too much money because we care for women. And I mean, I've been doing this for 10 plus years without pay. But at a certain point, we also have to make money to live. And it's tough because I think it's easy for us to be like, well, it's okay. I'll just donate my services. I'll just volunteer. And I do that. And I do it gratefully and willingly, but I also am feeling the need to actually make this a career because otherwise it's like expending energy with no nutrition, right?
You're
giving and you're not getting any energy exchange back, and at a certain point it's not sustainable. So I'm really hoping I can find somebody or some organization who would love to pay me to do the things that I'm already doing.
I
love it. So
Well, I'm right there with you. I mean, I, like I said, super appreciate all that you've done, but would never expect anyone to spend that much time without pay. And, you know, obviously the birth community, I think, needs to rally around someone like you and make sure that you are supported to do this work and that it benefits all of us, obviously. So I am with you on that, and if there's any way we can help, I have no idea, but maybe we'll talk about that later. You need to be supported in this work. This is not, you are not a charity, and you are spending lots of time. I can't even imagine the intensity of this kind of work. Wow.
Yeah, it's been, you know, like I said, it's really gratifying, and I don't begrudge any of that time or money that I've spent on my own to go to all these conferences, but it would be really nice to actually have it come the other way at some point.
Yes.
Anyway, so with other things I would like to do in the future, especially if I can find collaborators with the skills that I don't have, First, I would love to put together a translation team and have a whole website versus maybe even publishing outlet dedicated to translating articles relating to childbirth somehow into either into English or from English into other languages, because there's this real linguistic barrier that we have between. I noticed this when I was in Russia recently at the 8th International Life Birth Pelvis Conference in October.
Yeah.
There's a boundary that medical and obstetric knowledge doesn't always cross. And I saw that really, really distinctly when I was presenting about breech over in Russia, and they'd never even heard of the term breech trial.
Oh, wow.
Which to anybody in the kind of, how do I call it? Like North and South America and most of Europe, everybody knows about the TBT, whether they agree with it or not. It's common knowledge. And in Russia, they're like, what is this term breech trial? We don't know about this.
Wow.
And so, you know, political and linguistic barriers are still very much keeping knowledge from flowing. And then at the same time, we see this Russian obstetrician who's, you know, well known in textbooks even today, who we've never heard of. And we have the ability to translate and disseminate information quickly. I just need to find some way to do it that would be feasible. And, you know, I need to find translators who speak the languages I don't. I speak French fluently, so I've been translating a lot of French articles recently, and then I've had some German people help me. I knew German in high school, so I understand the grammar. I just totally forgot my vocabulary, so I need help with that, because just my vocabulary is shot, even though I understand the grammar and everything. But, you know, if we could get a team of other people as necessary to do some of these more obscure languages, then have a regular series of articles being published, of translations being published, I think that'd be an amazing project to have going on.
Right, like an international breech network.
Yeah, and not just breech necessarily, although I'd love to start with breech because that's what I'm doing, but, you know, some kind of thing related to even more widely, you know, not just breech, but anything about childbirth that we feel is relevant and that needs to be spread to people who don't speak those particular languages. So I would love to get something going with that and have this become a big thing where we are actively translating and putting out so many articles on a regular basis to keep this information flowing. So that's one thing I have in the works, especially if I can find people to come on board with their language skills. So any of you out there who speak other languages besides French, please get in touch.
Yeah.
And another thing I'd love to do is using all the knowledge and information that I've been able to put together from my PubMed searching and from all my other research, I really feel like we need to change the way that we do informed consent. And so I'm thinking in terms of breech, because right now everything's breech, but this is not just about breech, right?
Right,
but,
of course.
You know, we've given women like this big, long stack of paper with lots of medical jargon and numbers and statistics and risks and, you know, dangers. And then they're supposed to somehow make sense of all this complex information, which is often really hard to digest, even for people with a lot of medical training. And every provider might give a woman a different informed consent sheet, which may or may not guide them towards certain choices, right?
Right.
And then we expect them to be able to make sense of all this information and make an informed decision. And many of these women, they might not have medical training to interpret medical data. Some of them might not be very literate in the sense of reading skills. Like some people also learn better by listening. Some people learn better by watching. Some people learn better by kinesthetic movement. But the way we're informing women is largely by written materials that are very hard to understand, even for very well-educated people.
Right.
So I think we need to find a different way of doing informed consent. So I have this great idea, but I need somebody with computer coding and I need a graphic designer to come on board. I want to create an informed consent infographic video that's interactive. And so with infographics, you can take really complex data and represent it visually in a way that's easy to understand, but that doesn't lose complexity. And I think if we did this in an interactive video format using infographics, so with really, really good graphic design, making it interactive so that at any point the viewer / listener can stop it and click and follow it all back to the source material if they want to. And if we create a standardized tool that we get FIGO or ACOG or SOGC on board with to endorse, and that's, you know, has a team of experts and it's updated on a yearly basis, that we send everybody to the same tool. And we know everybody's watched this and has the best available, most up-to-date, most thorough information that also appeals to multiple learning styles and that is also customizable, Wouldn't that be a much better way of informing women about the risks and benefits of a complex decision, such as vaginal breech birth,
right,
such as VBAC, such as induction? You know, there's all these situations where I feel like right now informed consent is this scattershot thing where it varies widely from one hospital to another, from one provider to another. And women might not very well understand all this complex data in the way we're presenting it to them.
Right.
Another idea I have.
Yeah, that, I mean, that would really change, you know, that would really change the whole outlook, I think, if women had more understanding and accessible knowledge to make their decisions. I mean, that could change everything so quickly in probably a way that, you know, some organizations wouldn't even necessarily like, but would be
possible.
Great for women. It's possible.
Yeah. But think about it. I mean, if we're all starting from the same place and from a place that's very thorough and very understandable, and that is the best available evidence, that'd be so much more beneficial than having every single provider telling some women something different.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I can't imagine the differences all over the nation, all over the world with the information that women are given. And we know a lot of the time that it is biased and it is fearful and people are making choices based off of even limited knowledge that these practitioners have. So that sounds like a fabulous idea.
Yeah. So I have all the knowledge available. The problem is I need a graphic designer and I need a coder.
Right. Well, putting it out there.
To put it together. Yeah. So anybody who has those skills, get in touch with me.
Yeah. That's be a really amazing project to be in on for people with those skills, I would think. So yeah, put the call out. That's a great idea.
Yeah. And at a bare minimum, I'd love to put together a pilot version of it that we can then show to these organizations, you know, because we need to have something ready to show them, and then we can develop an even better version if we get funding and get people signing on. But yeah, so I'm not going to run out of things to do for many years.
It doesn't sound like it. It doesn't sound like you are anywhere at the end of projects. No.
I mean, my limitations are time, obviously, and also funding, because I'm paying for this myself and doing it on my spare time. I work part-time as a professor at Wabash College teaching English.
Oh, wow.
So I have, you know, I have a very, very small income from that. But I mean, I would teach one class every semester, and I would love to work full-time in my field because I enjoy teaching English, but it's not my life's passion. I want to be teaching and researching in my field. So, you know, again, I'm very focused on trying to get myself enough publications and enough, notoriety. That's not the right word.
Hmm.
Just to be well known enough that I could actually be hired on somewhere.
Eventually. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I totally support you in that. And, maybe something even as small as this podcast will hit the right ears. And I think your intention is obviously amazing, and that will, I hope, bring in just what you need to continue this work, because we all need you to do it. So it's it's important to everybody. It should be, anyway.
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for all that.
You're welcome.
You know, like I said, it's a whole different can of worms than birth work and attending births. You know, it sounds so labor intensive and hard in a different way. So I honor you for that. And again, thank you, and look forward to all of this amazing stuff that you're going to be putting out so that we can all learn from it. I'm thrilled.
Yeah, I'm super excited. So our first chapter, I don't know when it's going to come out, but we're working on the draft right now. I'm actually trying to finish up the first draft of it by the end of this week. And then we'll see what with the timing, but as soon as we have anything to announce, I will announce it for sure.
Yeah, we would love that. We are happy to help spread the word if you need it as well. And, you know, our students even will much benefit from all of this. So we're so excited. It's so great to hear the detail. I've seen through Facebook and different, you know, your blog that you're obviously working on a lot of things breech related, but I didn't even know the details. So I'm really thrilled.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Well, are you up to talking about your personal experience in birth a little bit? I think for the people that listen to this podcast, that might be a really sweet thing to hear if you're up for it.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Well, I feel like I certainly know your background, but I don't know that many people do. So, you know, what is your personal interest in birth? Obviously, you have children, but just start wherever you'd like and we'll see where it goes.
Yeah. So let me just say that growing up, I didn't exactly have the most rosy view of pregnancy and birth. I just was
Interesting.
kind of like horrified that we have to go through this awful process that seemed really degrading. And this was not at all anything that I was interested in. I knew I'd eventually probably have kids, but I was not excited about the process and just was kind of like trying to not think about it as much as possible.
Wow, that's
Oh.
fascinating.
It's so funny because it's so not what I'm doing today, right?
Right, yeah.
Let me tell you a funny story about how I was born. So my mom had my older sister in a really great, I mean, she said it was great labor. It was in a hospital with a fantastic nurse. Unmedicated birth went really well. And so I was number two, and she's kind of expecting the same thing. She had moved to Rochester, Minnesota, home of the Mayo Clinic, and kind of just expected that it, you know, similar kind of experience. You know, she had a fairly straightforward, easy first birth. And so when she went into labor with me at the hospital, the whoever doctor was on call for her strung her from her ankles from the ceiling, and she gave birth to me strung upside down from her ankles. The only thing touching the bed was her head and her shoulder
Oh
blades.
my goodness.
Against her will, I mean, she was screaming to be let down. You know, she just, I remember her describing, like, you know, the door was open. There were people walking past in the hallway looking at her as she's literally hanging upside down from her ankles.
Wow.
And maybe that story, which I'd only heard once or twice growing up, but I knew it was there vaguely. Maybe that colored my perception of birth a little bit too. But it was definitely a shocker for my mom. She was furious. She would be screaming to be let down, and he wouldn't let her down. So that's kind of a very funny slash not funny story about how I was born.
Yeah, definitely not funny.
My mom said the doctor told her after, well, he had this theory that if you were upside down, it would prevent hemorrhoids. And my mom's like, I've never had hemorrhoids, but it was his theory that if you're upside down without gravity putting pressure on the woman's rectum, then she wouldn't then get hemorrhoids during birth. So that was the reason he strung her upside down. So,
Wow.
okay, so fast forward, I am a PhD, new PhD student at the University of Iowa. I was, let's see, I started when I was 24, my PhD program. And I knew I would want to have kids at some point, but I was definitely not at all in that headspace yet. I got married when I was really young. So I was 20 when I got married. And sometime during my first year, I was taking this class called like Feminist Research Methodologies or something like that. And I had to find a topic for my semester paper. And we had a colleague of mine, a fellow grad student who was pregnant and who had her baby over the winter break. And I remember talking with her shortly after classes started up in January about her experience. And she said something like she really wanted to have a home birth, but she couldn't find any midwives because in Iowa, direct entry midwives are not legally recognized. And so she ended up having a nurse midwife at the university hospital and had a really not a really bad experience. It just was really dissatisfied with her care and definitely said she would go with a home birth midwife the next time around. And I was just fascinated. I had no idea that it was illegal to have a midwife at home unless you could find one of the rare nurse midwives. You know, I didn't know anything about the politics of midwifery or about home birth or anything like that.
Right.
So I just started reading books. I was like, that might be an interesting semester topic to write about. And the very first book I read was Peggy Vincent's memoir called Baby Catcher.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And she was a midwife in Berkeley in the 70s and 80s, worked in a hospital, became a midwife, worked in birth centers, did home births, and had done everything, you know, anything and everything in Berkeley in that time. And it's a hilarious memoir. It's super, super well written. I've read it multiple times because I actually used to use it for some of my composition classes.
Right.
So it's really engaging. And I remember reading that and I was completely sold. I was ready to have children. I really wanted to have a home birth because I saw that birth didn't have to be this horrible thing that I had in my mind.
Yeah.
And once I saw that there was a different way of doing it and that it could be something really empowering and something that was life-giving and enriching and something not to be feared, but something to be looked forward to, I was ready. I was like, yeah, I want to do this. I didn't
Wow.
actually end up getting pregnant for a couple more years. We had some infertility that was totally not expected and actually went through IVF, didn't work. And a couple of years later, I finally got pregnant on my own. And then obviously had not had really many problems since then, but it was more of the issue on my husband's part. Another story. Anyway, but I was like, I'm ready to do this thing. It totally made me ready for motherhood.
And wow, go Peggy Vincent, huh?
I know. Thank you, Peggy. Thank you for listening. Thank you. I have my four kiddos and I've done this. And thanks to that, I found, like, I was like, this is my life's passion. I'm so interested in this. And so that's actually what made me choose my final field of study during my PhD. I was in American Studies, which is really flexible, and each student basically creates their own program of study.
Yeah.
And so I did two primary emphases. One was history of medicine and child healthcare, and the other was U.S. environmental history, because I was also very interested in environmentalism. In the history of medicine stuff, I focused a lot on maternal child health as much as I could with the classes that I had access to at the University of Iowa. Okay. And like I said, I wrote my dissertation about unassisted birth. So that got me to my dissertation, and I got pregnant and had my first baby and got pregnant with my second during my dissertation writing stage.
Oh, okay. I was wondering about the timing of all of that.
Yeah. So luckily, it actually worked out really well that we didn't get pregnant right away because I was still in the middle of taking classes. It would have been a lot harder. But I'd already finished my comprehensive exams before I got pregnant. So it was perfect timing-wise.
Hmm.
And so I was researching unassisted birth because I was thinking more and more that that would be something interesting to write a dissertation about. It was really heavily in the news media starting in about 2007 and 8, which is right when I was writing. It was this big uptick of interest in articles about it. And I also just became very personally drawn towards it. And it was one of those things that I almost couldn't explain. Like, it was this, just this inner knowledge that it was something that I needed to do.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that's hard because I feel like I have both a very rational side of myself, but also kind of a strange intuitive side that I like to pretend I don't have sometimes. I'm so much a left brain person. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm mostly in the world of logic and reason, intellect. But I do have this other side of myself, and, you know, it's intuitive, maybe I'd even call it spiritual or religious, that kind of all intercombine, and I really felt drawn or guided or led towards unassisted birth.
Right.
For my first, which is kind of crazy for a lot of people, and even for myself, I was like, this is, you know, I felt it was the right choice, but I also recognized it was very unusual.
Yeah, for sure. That definitely is unusual. And like you say, especially for someone like you that spends a lot of time in their brain, I think it's a fascinating thing for you to be drawn to.
You know, it's just so interesting because once I changed my attitude about pregnancy, it was so interesting to go through the process, like the embodied process. And it was so, I was just endlessly fascinated, especially with the first pregnancy, which was fairly easy.
Right.
Didn't have any mothers to take care of. I didn't get very sick, you know.
Right.
It was a really easy pregnancy, and I just felt like I was glorying in this physical process the whole time and just almost learning a new side of myself that I'd never explored, like this physicality of myself, because I never felt very much connected to my body in that sense like I did when I was pregnant.
So did you do care with a midwife, or did you do your own prenatal care? How did that look for you in that pregnancy?
I was assisting a nurse midwife. I moved to Illinois by that point after I finished my comprehensive exams. My husband got a job in Illinois. He's also an academic. He has a PhD in creative writing. So I was assisting a home birth nurse midwife, kind of as her assistant, going to births with her. And she was great. Like, she's a fantastic midwife. But I just didn't really, I was like, I just don't know if I want her at my birth. I had nothing against her. She's amazing. Mm. I just was like, oh, I don't know if it's quite what I want. And so she did a couple, she tested my iron once or twice. I asked her to, and she was really nice to do stuff. But mostly I took care of myself. I took my own blood pressure. I had a fetoscope. I'd measure my fundus. I had all those Excel spreadsheets. I love Excel spreadsheets. So I would keep tracking. Like, I knew everything about myself, you know, and I'd track on a weekly basis and was really pretty aware of everything I could be. I read like crazy. I mean, that's kind of my personality too. I'm a big reader, but I read every textbook. I would just read everything I could get my hands on. And I, you know, I had gone to several births as a doula, and then I'd been assisting two different nurse midwives, one in Iowa when I was a grad student still at the University of Iowa, and then, you know, the one in Illinois during my dissertation writing stage. But yeah, for the most part, I did it myself. I just, you know, I felt pretty self-sufficient, and I would have definitely seen somebody if I felt like there was anything that I couldn't figure out on my own. But since I could do most of the basic prenatal stuff, like all the clinical stuff, I could do it on myself. So I didn't really ever see a need to see somebody regularly, except for a couple small things.
Yeah, I mean, that's wonderful, and very well supported by the listeners that I'm sure are listening.
And, you know, it was a great birth, like very textbook. It took maybe, 10, 11 hours start to finish. You know, the contractions got longer and stronger and closer together. I pushed for about 2 hours. She had a lot of head molding. So there was definitely a lot of molding going on. I think that's why it took so long. It's not terribly long, but it was longer than my other births for sure.
Sure.
But, you know, really straightforward. No big surprises that way. And, you know, part of it is I'm also a very independent person, and I don't, when I'm emotionally stressed, even in a good way, like if there's intense emotion going on in my life, whether it's good or bad, I kind of like being by myself.
Yeah.
I'm very solitary, and I kind of knew I just needed to be left alone. I mean, even with my husband, I actually didn't have him in the room most of the time, because I was like, I'm fine, just leave me alone, you know, I'll let you know if I need anything. And he would just sit in the bedroom next door. I was in our bathroom for the most part. And, you know, I could hear him playing online Scrabble, probably to distract himself. He would pop in ever so often to give me something to eat or drink and just make sure I was okay. But mostly I was just like, I didn't even want to be watched by him. It was just, I needed to be really just on my own. I had this real need to do it myself with no interference. So yeah, she was born 38 weeks, which totally surprised me, because I'm like, I'm going to go late. I'm sure I'm going to go late, because then I won't be disappointed if I do. And right. I'm so ready to have this, you know, 41 weeker and then
right.
38. So it's great. You know, nothing really crazy or out of the ordinary really with that at all. The midwife I had been assisting was super kind, and I called her up after the birth, and she came over and checked me for tears a couple hours after. And I did have some second degree tearing, so she was really nice and stitched me up. And I actually really feel grateful for that, even to this day, because I had not asked her beforehand if she would do that, and she could have said no, because, I mean, that was a lot to ask of her. But I was really happy to have that available for me, because I would have hated to go to the hospital for that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a ridiculous reason to have to go to a hospital and pay who knows how many thousands of dollars, you know, for a perineal laceration, which was not really horrible. And she said it lined up really nicely, but I was more comfortable having it stitched, since it was, you know, into the muscle tissue.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And I was going to say, with your research that you had done already into an assisted birth, I'm sure you extra appreciated that, knowing that sometimes the politics of unassisted births and midwives and all of those things don't always get along, so to speak.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I need to write her actually and just say thank you again. I really appreciate it, because it was a big favor that I asked of her, and she came. So
yeah,
I love the postpartum stage. I know some women really struggle with it, and it's hard. And for me, it is the most magical time of my entire life. And if I could do that, again, I would love it. I just love having the newborn baby. I mean, it's tiring, but I love breastfeeding. I love having this tiny little baby to have on my body all the time. It's my favorite thing. The sensuality of having like a naked newborn on your chest, and just especially right post-birth, is like one of the most blissful experiences I've ever had in my life.
It really totally is.
It has to end, you know, because I can't keep having babies forever.
Well, yeah, I understand that sentiment for sure.
Yeah.
It's such a fleeting memory. Like, you know, it's there and you know how awesome it is and you crave to do it again, but it's like, it just is so fleeting and over so quickly.
No.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't have any major problems, like no horrible breastfeeding problems. I had some plugged ducts, but like, you know, everything went really smoothly for me, for which I'm mostly thankful. And, you know, I attribute it. It's probably, you know, half chance and half preparation. I don't want to say that. You know, I prepared a lot, but I know a lot of women prepare and they have a really hard time with things. So I don't want to be like, I had an awesome time because I just did my research, because that sounds so skinny. You know, it's a combination of, you know, I did what I could to prepare, and I also just happened to have, you know, I had babies who breastfed well. And I think it's, you know, Yeah. We just feel very fortunate that it went really smoothly.
Yeah, that's amazing. So yeah. Did you, then you were kind of in the middle then of the UC dissertation for your unassisted birth? Like how did that kind of wind up? Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I had Zari, my oldest, and I wrote the dissertation during nap time.
I saw that. I read it and saw that. Thank you to my daughter for napping, or however you said it so sweetly.
Nap time and bedtime. Yes. I have a neighbor girl next door who is maybe 8 or 9 years old. She would come over and play with my daughter for maybe an hour or two, several afternoons a week. And that also really helped, just having somebody to take her in another room. I could just lock myself in my room for a couple hours. And because I knew I only had that time, I only could work during nap time, babysitting time, or bedtime, I was very productive during those few hours I had every day.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, I say that all the time, you know, back to the pre-kid days. I wonder what I did with all of my time. You find a way, right, to get it done. Yeah. That's true.
So, yeah, I was several months pregnant, maybe 6-7 months pregnant, I'm trying to think, when I graduated with my second baby.
Yeah.
When I finished my PhD, it was, I graduated in the winter and he was born in April. So yeah, 5 or 6 months pregnant maybe at that point. And it's interesting. So the rest of my babies, I didn't really feel drawn towards an assisted birth the same way I did with my first, even though I had a great experience. Like I have no regrets about the way it happened or anything. And I felt a lot more drawn towards having a midwife, which was a real struggle for me to accept. Like,
independent you.
How is this going to work? Because I knew I needed to be mostly left alone and not bothered. I just did not want anybody messing with my space.
Sure.
And I was so fortunate to find an amazing nurse midwife, Penny Lane. She's great. She's at Believe Midwifery Services in near Indianapolis. Anyway,
nice.
She really got what I wanted. She'd had a lot of crazy birth experiences. She's done some, you know, she had breech babies, unassisted babies, C-sections, hospital births, she'd gone through the ringer herself personally with some of her birth experiences, and she really got what I wanted. And she was 100% happy being a very inobtrusive presence and largely leaving me alone. And we got to know each other really well. And because there is this professional connection, because I'm, you know, an academic, I'm working in the world of childbirth, like I knew birth besides, I was in birth as more than just a mother or a consumer.
Right.
There is this, I think there is this trust, like she knew me and I knew her, and we had this mutual language that we would share over what maybe a typical woman would share with her midwife. And so I think she and I both trust each other. Like she would trust that I would really do it myself just fine. And if I needed help, that I would ask her. And I trusted her that she would really just leave me alone. And, you know, she listened to heart tones, but otherwise would totally leave me alone. And I trusted that if something needed doing, she would do it. And if she came into my space, that meant something needed doing. And I just told her that. I'm like, if there's an emergency, I'll obviously come and help. If not, just leave me alone and I'll tell you if I need help. And it was great.
Yeah. I mean, that's the way it should be, really, ideally.
Yeah. And some women really like their midwife to be all hands-on and like, you're the birthing goddess, and like massaging them and guiding them and leading them through this process. And I was like, just leave me alone. I'm fine. Mm-hmm. And I'll, you know, holler if I need help. And that's my style. And really the flavor or the tenor of my other three births was so similar to my first one, in large part because I knew myself and I had a care provider who knew exactly what I wanted and who met me where I went, where I needed her to,
right?
For which I was endlessly grateful. And so I did it myself every time, right? I mean,
besides
her popping in really on occasion to listen to heart tones, there's really no difference. Like I did it myself and she was just there to, in case something happened that needed skills beyond what I could do. So, you know, I really, like my second baby, Dio, was really straightforward, a lot faster pushing stage, not surprisingly. You know, usually your first pushing stage is long. Labor was maybe like 5-7 hours plus to finish. You know, but not crazy fast. You know, it was just really straightforward, like, As boring and unexciting as a labor can be in a very good sense, right? Just everything happens smoothly and without too many surprises.
Yeah, boringly normal textbook labors are great. Sure, I'll take them.
Yeah, it's great, you know. Inga was the interesting one that I got the most.
Yeah, let's talk about her birth. That for sure. Yeah. I remember reading about. That was quite a internet birth story. Yeah.
So again, I had the same midwife for all the last three, but with Inga, her labor was very fast. So with all my babies, it's labor always started right about midnight, 1 a.m. as far as like stronger contractions. And Zari's, I could not stay out of bed. I had to move through them. But the last three, I was like, I am not getting out of my warm, cozy bed. And they weren't quite bad enough. I could just deal with them lying down with covers on and lights off and kind of snoozing in between on occasion.
Right.
And so, you know, did that for Gio and then Inga, same thing. And right about, you know, 6 or 7 a.m, I couldn't handle being in bed anymore and I had to get up and move. And, you know, Dio, I did that when he was born at like 2:30 p.m. With Inga, number three, I did that and she was born 2 hours later.
Wow. Yeah. So really third fast. Surprise babies.
Yeah. And I even called the midwife and I was like, you need to come really soon. It's happening quite fast. Like I knew I could just sense that it was happening faster. But she took her time. She took a shower. And it's so funny because afterwards she's like, I knew I should have come. It was Rexa telling me to come. Why did I go in the shower? You know, like, of all things, when Rexa says come, you better come.
Yeah.
And so, let's see. So, yeah, she was born just a little over 2 hours after I got out of bed. And so the midwife is still on her way, which, again, didn't bother me at all. Like, it wasn't fazed by it. Just that was what's happening. And so Inga was born, and it was really similar to Dio, you know, pushing stage of maybe 20, 30 minutes. Otherwise, nothing out of the ordinary, except that it was faster than the other ones. And she was born, and she had color and tone when she came out. She was actually opening her eyes. She was, like, moving, you know, lifting up her arms, wiggling her body, like, arching backwards, like, a lot of tone.
Yeah.
But she never breathed. And then after about 30 seconds, she just completely lost her tone and completely lost her color and turned like grayish. And just like looked like the glassy, lifeless eyes. If you've ever seen a baby that hasn't come around yet and their eyes just look like blank mirrors, that's what it looked like.
Totally. So, and the video is still accessible. Yeah. It's on YouTube. It's on your site.
There. You can watch the whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's on my website. Mm-hmm. And I had taken neonatal resuscitation class with it's strange because when I was a doula before Zari was born, I had to resuscitate a really, really, really scary looking baby, like way worse than Inga.
Oh, wow.
And so I was like, after that happened, after I had to resuscitate because midwife was in the middle of a blizzard and on her way in Iowa.
Wow.
And I thought I should probably make sure I know what I'm doing. I mean, luckily I knew what I was doing even the first time because I'd read a lot of books about how to resuscitate. I just never taken a class.
Right.
So with Inga, like I'd taken the training, and it's funny because I got a lot of criticism because I didn't do things quite as fast as the NRP flowchart tells you to.
Oh my goodness. That is a whole other topic, the criticism around the awesome job that you did with your own child. It's phenomenal. Anybody that hasn't seen this video needs to go watch this Inga's birth, the water birth, where Rixa does an amazing just self-guided, intuitive. I mean, I know you've read books, but come on, you are her mom and you did it as you needed to do it. So that's what I have to say about it.
Yeah, I know. It's funny because in my memory, it happened a lot faster.
Right.
Like I didn't start giving her the first, I went back and timed it just recently because I was giving a presentation in Russia about mother-led resuscitation and mother's breath.
Yes.
In conjunction with Sister Morningstar.
Yeah.
And so I went through and did, I finally went through and did the logical thing, like really analyzed it to death. I timed it all. I timed how many breaths I gave her and at what point it happened and when she started opening her eyes and when she started coughing and when she finally started crying and like wrote down the times of all this because I had never done that before. And it was funny because I would have said I gave her a breath a lot faster, like, but it was about 1 minute after she was born when I gave her first breath.
Right.
Because it took a while for me. It was surprising to me because she had so much color and tone right away. So I knew she wasn't compromised in the sense of, you know, she wasn't like half dead coming out, right? Like, It surprised me that she lost color and tone having been so vigorous when she first came out. And so I just wasn't anticipating that there would be a problem as I would have with this first baby that came out looking like gray and lifeless.
Right, of course.
So I think that just took me a few seconds to be like, oh, this is weird. This is not what I was expecting.
Yeah.
So So I gave her several breaths, and I did it more slowly. Like, I would give her a breath and then take a look and see what was happening. And then I'd give her another breath. I wasn't giving her continuous breaths with no pause. And again, that's different than the NRP guideline. Whatever. I'm really not apologetic of it, because I feel like in the moment it was what she needed and it was fine. Like, I knew that she had some reserves because she was pink and vigorous coming out. So it wasn't like she was so compromised that being a little more thoughtful and careful wasn't going to harm her. Like, that was kind of my thought as much as I was even thinking about it logically at the time. Right.
Right.
And I gave her several breaths and some of them didn't seal well. So if you watch the video, a few of them, like, I gave her a breath that I could feel in the air where I hadn't actually gone in her lungs. Cause if you don't get a good air seal, right, it just kind of sticks around your lips. And she started opening her eyes and lifting her arms up again. So she got tone back first and then she started coughing. And then right around 2 minutes, she gave her first cry and then she was fine. Like, you know, totally pink and fine and 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an amazing, I mean, I know you didn't plan it this way, of course, but it wound up to be an amazing teaching video. And I'm sure you've been through it a couple billions of times.
But and the funny thing is, when you watch the video, right after Inga cries and I settle back with her, ding dong, the midwife's assistant rings the doorbell and comes in. The thing I like about the video is she gets all in my face. She doesn't know me, so she doesn't know that I want to be left alone. She's like, chit chat, where are the gloves? Oh, blah, 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 blah. Oh, I had, you know, chatting about her, like, random stuff on the day. Like, it was so bothering me. And I finally just kicked her out of the room.
Yeah.
And I love that it's in that video because it really shows, like, you as a birth attendant, you have to guard the woman's space and not bother her. And she wasn't doing anything bad, but she was sure bothering me.
Yeah.
And as a woman giving birth, you have the right to kick people out of your space if they're bothering you. And without any apology, like, you just say, leave me alone, I'm fine. And luckily she got the hint and she left right away and then it was great. But for those couple minutes, I was just like so annoyed, like, you know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And I mean, the obvious is thank goodness that you didn't have to deal with that while your baby was having trouble. So you took care of it in the most intuitive, calm, and powerful way. Another reason to love you, Rixa, and to honor you for what you've put out in the world, even without meaning to. It's, you know, that's a great tool. And thanks to Inga, too, of course. She very much participated in that learning opportunity for many people.
That birth it's just odd. I mean, I never, ever saw her cord have any blood in it. Like, from my earliest memory of looking at her cord, it was white and limp. Hmm. And there's another strange thing. Like, I had almost zero postpartum bleeding. Like, you know, when I birthed placenta, usually there's, you know, a little bit of blood. There was 10 cc's of blood total. Wow. The midwife was so shocked. She's like, I have to take a picture of this. I've never seen so little blood in my life. And I don't know if any of those are connected. It was just different, you know.
Yeah.
I'll never really know what's going on inside, you know, as she was being born. But I never saw a cord at all, like a full cord, you know, the blue plump cord. Never from, you know, and who knows when I looked at it, but I know at least by 2 minutes it was completely white and limp, you know, if not even earlier. It's just very strange, but it's a mystery. I don't really know. We'll never really know what happened, right? But fortunately it went well.
Yeah. I mean, for sure, enter the mystery of birth, which is, you know, I don't know, at least 25%, if not more, I think with all of these scenarios, we can only know what we know, but that's interesting. I'll have to think about that some more.
Yeah. And the nice thing about it, I tend to be a very calm person anyway, and fairly not emotional, sometimes to my husband's frustration. But anyway,
I understand that.
The good thing is I never, ever felt any adrenaline or any fear. And that's such a blessing. I mean, panicking does not help a situation like that.
Right.
But even in my memory of it, like, there's no trauma. There's no, like, residual fear. Mm-hmm. Even in my memory. And I think that's such a gift. And to me, that speaks to the necessity of being prepared for these kinds of things so that if it happens, you just calmly do what you need to do instead of panicking and then having who knows how many years of trauma after the fact, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't hurt to know what to do in certain situations that might arise. So I tell people, you know, why not know what to do if you need to help your baby breathe, which is probably the most common thing you're going to need to do.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And it's a great testament to, like you're saying, having people take responsibility for that, whether or not they have a midwife, whether or not they expect a midwife to arrive, you know, and having some security in that they have what they need. And yeah. Like I said, it's just a great teaching tool. I feel like I send that to a lot of people. And the moms I work with too, you know, it's like, hey, you know, this is a thing and sometimes midwives don't make it. And here's a great representation of a mom helping her own baby in the way that she knew she needed to. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So how old is Inga now? How many years ago was that?
That was 6.5 years ago.
Oh my gosh. No way.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
Six and a half years ago. Oh my gosh.
And then, so I have one more baby, Ivy, and they're all about 2 years apart. And Ivy, I had a photographer there and, you know, I videoed that one again. I think I got more and more comfortable having a little bit more people in my space as time went on, just because I knew how I labored and
I really wanted
to have some beautiful photos this time around.
Yeah, that's so great.
I'm so glad to have that. And Ivy's birth was probably the most challenging.
Why so?
So here's a couple things that I noticed. I suspect she was probably OP during the whole labor, posterior. Yeah. I didn't have some of the classic signs. Like I never had any sacral pain, like I had read about in books. But I was having constant low-level rectal pressure almost the whole labor, which I never had before.
Sorry, say that again?
Having constant rectal pressure almost the whole labor.
Mm-hmm.
Not horrible, like I'm pushing a baby out rectal pressure, but like it was there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In between my contractions, it never fully felt like the intensity went away, which every other time I labored, it's like the contraction end and it's done. And there's no pain. There's no tightness. There's nothing.
Right.
And this one, it never felt like it relaxed all the way. Like there was always some sense of intensity or tightness that was always there. And my endorphin level felt very much dampened in between contractions.
Interesting.
And I also pushed like a good 45, 50 minutes with her. And I could feel like something was not moving, especially towards the end. Like she was just like one or two knuckles deep and it was just not moving past then. And it was just like, it was so intense. Like it was the most intense, especially in the pushing stage of all my labors.
Wow. And you don't expect that the fourth time, you know, stereotypically and all.
It wasn't horrible. It was just definitely more challenging and more intense than I would have anticipated. And based on the combination of all those things, like the rectal pressure, the feeling of like the intensity never quite subsiding in between contractions, the lower level of endorphins, like I wasn't feeling them as strongly as I usually would have felt. I'm thinking that there was probably some kind of positioning thing going on.
Yeah.
But in the end, I had a mega contraction maybe like 5 minutes before she was born. And I'm guessing she spun around at that point and emerged. Because she didn't emerge OP. And, you know, I'm really hands-on when I have my babies. Like, I'm feeling them. I'm supporting their head. So, like, I kind of know what's happening.
Yeah, totally. Well, and it's the blessing and the curse of knowing anything at all about birth. I mean, I can totally sympathize with that. It's your brain is going, you're trying to sometimes figure things out or looking at the clock or, you know, it's different than someone that can just be in the bliss of what their body is doing.
Yeah. But otherwise, really uneventful. It's just a little more challenging than I was, you know, it's pretty challenging. Mm-hmm. Just really intense, I would say. More intense than my other ones. But, you know, otherwise totally, you know, I don't want to say easy. It's not easy, but very straightforward and doable, even though it was the most difficult
right. In
that sense. And it was, you know, I kind of knew at that point that she was probably our last. My husband was very much done with four. I was kind of on the fence. Do I want to have another, you know, number five? I had five kids in my family. So five always seemed like a reasonable number. Because that's what I was used to.
Yeah.
But so I kind of knew at that point that she was my last, and it was just really bittersweet. Like I'm knowing that I'm doing it for the last time. You know, so everything is like, this is the last time I'll ever have a baby. This is the last time I'll ever have a silky newborn on my chest. You know, that kind of that enjoying it, but also feeling sad about it at the same time as it's happening.
Yeah. You know? So. Yeah, I do know. I've said that a couple times already, though. So I've had my bittersweetness and I'm like, I don't know. Maybe that really was the end. And now I've missed it. I didn't hang on to it enough, you know?
Yeah.
Wow. So maybe you really are done. You're moving on to all these other exciting ventures, it sounds like, which is awesome. Just a different phase of life, perhaps.
Yeah. And, you know, once I realized, if I had 10 babies, I'd still be sad when I was done. I realized and accepted that, I could accept being done with 4, because having another one isn't going to make that bittersweetness ever go away.
Yeah, tell me that 10 more times and maybe I'll hear you. No, it's a good point though. And, you know, in any case, I mean, each person coming to kind of like their own conclusion about that is what you've got to do, really.
Yeah.
When you're a birth nerd, like we are, especially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, wow. Thank you so much. It was amazing to hear your actual voice telling these stories. I feel like I've, you know, read the blog posts and seen the videos, but this was really special. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And why don't you let the listeners know your blog and, you know, any other way you'd like them to get a hold of you?
Okay. Yeah, my blog is called Stand and Deliver, which I think is appropriate given the way I was born upside down. I feel like I'm kind of putting things back right again. And it's easy to find. It's rixa.blogspot.com. If you just search Rixa or Rixa Freeze or Stand and Deliver, you'll find me pretty easily.
Yep.
And you can also find me on Facebook. I do most things public, so even if I don't friend you, because I don't tend to friend people I don't really know, but I do almost all my posts publicly anyway, so you can find me there as well. I'm not on Facebook a ton as far as posting, but I use it so I can mostly find other people.
Yeah.
And if you need to get in touch with me via email, that's linked on my blog on my About page. I'd love to hear from people, especially if you want to get involved with some of these projects I'm working on, or if you know somebody who might want to help, especially with translation stuff that I'm really eager to get some of these Russian and Czech and Polish articles translated. I also have some German ones I need pretty soon for this book chapter. Hint, hint, any German speakers out there? I have this part of the chapter I have to write, but I can't write it until I get these articles translated. Anyway, yeah, get in touch with me. Feel free to message me on Facebook or send me an email if you want to talk more or connect or get involved in any of these projects.
Awesome. Yeah, I do want to talk with you more later myself. And everybody else, feel free to contact Rixa. And thank you again for being here. This has been really awesome. For the listeners, just check out the Indie Birth site for all new offerings, the IndieBirthMidwiferySchool.com. We are accepting applications for school starting in July, so you can check that out. Otherwise, thanks for listening and have a great day.